You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestel. This week, we journey into the frozen north of North America on the hunt for the most fearsome of paranormal creatures, the Wendigo. With the oral tradition going back over three centuries, we join our guides, Chad Lewis and Kevin Lee Nelson, to investigate just what this creature is, some of the terrifying tales of this cannibalistic killer, and what the native traditions warn us of. Chad and Kevin's latest book, Wendigo Lore, is a wonderful journey into the icy heart of Wendigo country, and it is a book I simply couldn't put down. If you want to learn more about either the legends surrounding the Wendigo or some of the shocking cases of alleged Wendigo possession and how the tribe's people dealt with them, then you will be hard-pressed to find a better volume to dive into. A big thank you to both Chad and Kevin for joining me on this week's show, and thank you to David Weatherly for introducing us. It certainly won't be Chad and Kevin's last appearance on Mysteries and Monsters. I'd also like to congratulate Ryan Sprague with his newly updated and expanded release of his brilliant book, Somewhere in the Skies, hitting number one within 24 hours of release. Well deserved, Ryan, and if you don't own a copy, make sure you pick one up as soon as you can. As always, you can support the show via our Patreon page. Just search for Mysteries and Monsters or click on the link in this week's show notes. You can subscribe to our channel on YouTube under Mysteries and Monsters, along with our Facebook page. And we are on Twitter and Instagram as Mystery Monsters. Before we join Chad and Kevin on this week's show, I've become an uncle for the second time. So congratulations to my brother and his wife, Steph. And my niece now has a baby brother. Love you guys, and I'm looking forward to meeting Jacob. Thanks to Dean again for his artwork, especially in current circumstances, and Brennan Storr from the Ghost Story Guys for his production duties. Now, let's make sure we've hatchets and some hot tallow at hand as we join Chad Lewis and Kevin Lee Nelson on the hunt for the Wendigo. If there is one creature in the pantheon of the paranormal most of us would not wish to encounter, it has to be the fearsome Wendigo. With an insatiable appetite for human flesh and centuries of reported cases, two men have bravely taken it upon themselves to track this terrifying beast on our behalf. Chad Lewis and Kevin Lee Nelson join me to discuss their fabulous book, Wendigo Lore, which I highly recommend. Chad, Kevin, welcome to the show. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you for having us.
Greetings from the Northwoods of Wisconsin. Absolute pleasure to have you both on. What a fantastic book. For a chap based in the UK, I have to be brutally honest, I've kind of known about the Wendigo for about 40 years due to my love of Marvel Comics and the X-Men in particular, primarily because in a very old X-Men edition, Wolverine stumbled across the Wendigo, which for me as a young chap was my first experience of this fearsome creature. So for you two, Is it something that you've been aware of since your interest in the paranormal, or is it something that you've kind of gravitated towards as you've learnt more about the paranormal, gentlemen?
Well, speaking for myself, this is Kevin. I would say, you know, if I think about it, probably my first encounter with that is very similar to your own. I also was a comic book fan. I knew about the character of the Wendigo in Marvel Comics. You know, I was of that age as well when it was kind of being introduced into the comics. You know, so I had a vague awareness that there was this creature, but I think it wasn't until much later on that I realized that it was something beyond a comic book invention. And, you know, somewhere in my teens, I encountered, you know, started finding out that there was this thing out there in the Northwoods, in the northern parts of the Great Lakes region in America and Canada, that was also called the Wendigo. And then I started putting two and two together and realized that, oh, okay, that's where Marvel got it from. You know, it wasn't, they didn't just completely invent it out of thin air.
Yeah, same for me, that growing up in the Great Lakes area of the Midwest here in the United States, we'd always heard of the Wendigo, but again, it was just this abstract thing growing up. But then when I started studying psychology at college, I ran across a belief of Wendigo psychosis, a mental illness, if you will. And that really sparked my interest, because at the same time, I was getting into research of the supernatural and paranormal. And that really put me on a course to dig a little bit deeper into this creature. And you're not alone, Paul, that, I mean, there are researchers all over the world, even tons of them here in the United States, that have never really heard of the Wendigo in depth. They may have heard the name, know a little bit more that it's a terrifyingly crazed creature that's deadly and fear-provoking, but that's about it.
Yeah, to kind of hop off Chad's point, you know, even in Wendigo land, where we live in the Great Lakes region in the North Woods, you know, even people that have heard of the name Wendigo, which isn't, it's still not even that common. I mean, if you asked a regular person on the street what a Wendigo was, they probably hadn't even heard of it. But even the people that have just have this really vague idea of what it is. And that's one of the huge problems that we faced writing this book, is, you know, really nailing down what exactly this is, because it's kind of this abstract boogeyman in the minds of a lot of people in this region. You know, it's this Northwoods monster, but if you press people on details about it, they can't really tell you. And so that we kind of took it upon ourselves to really nail down what, you know, are and what its history is.
It's a perplexing creature, because it seems to have a variety of shapes and structure to it, depending on where the particular tales come from. And what I found incredible, as you refer to, I think most people's knowledge is fairly basic and a simplified version of this legend, or they have a particular version of the Wendigo in their minds, or they may be aware of it. So for you two guys, I mean, I found it incredible that there's such a variety of versions of this monster, depending on which part of the northern area of the US and Canada that you reflect upon. So for you guys, was it more interesting the more you dug into this case? Because there just seems to be so many versions of it, that it seems to be a variety of terrifying beasts.
You're exactly right, and that was one of the most difficult things that we faced writing this book. I mean, not only do you see regional variances of it and different varieties, you know, from tribe to tribe or region to region, but even in its just most basic sense, there's at least three different versions of it that are very different. And it was very difficult for us in the beginning to really figure out how these three seemingly unrelated forms work together. And after years of research and digging and interviews and poring over archives, we eventually became to realize that, or develop a theory that, what we're really looking at is a process rather than three distinct types of creatures, or, you know, one that's correct and two that are not correct. So basically, what, in a nutshell, what a Wendigo is it's a process where basically there's a Wendigo spirit. And this goes all the way back to Ojibwe and Cree lore. They believe that there's this spirit called the Wendigo. And when a person is in a weakened state, weakened physically or weakened spiritually, this spirit can invade a person, similar to what you know, in Western culture, we would maybe look at as like almost like demonic possession. Hmm. Once it invades someone, it starts to take over their personality, take over their body. And eventually its goal is to, or a side effect of, is this person starts to crave human flesh. And once this person is possessed, that's sort of the second phase, or the second type of Wendigo, is basically this cannibalistic human being. They're still a human being, but in many senses, you know, they're a monstrous human being. And mm-hmm. it's believed that once they finally actually engage in eating human flesh, that the process is at that point irreversible. And once they kind of pass that over that bridge, then they start to physically change and to become more ghastly and grow in size and become more hideous and more dangerous. And that's the third type of Wendigo, which people often hear about, where it's this sort of Northwoods ogre, this creature that is unstoppable and has an insatiable desire for human flesh. So it's the spirit, which is more this more intangible form. There's the cannibal possessed human, which is, you know, very in the material world and a human, but then they change into something far stranger, which is this monstrous creature. One of the analogies I give in the book is it's similar to the process of, you know, a caterpillar and a butterfly. You know, they're essentially the same organism, but they're very, very distinct and different life stages of that organism.
This was a 20-year process for us off and on, and we were learning the entire time. We had originally thought of doing this book a decade and a half ago, and we're so grateful that we didn't do it at that time, because our knowledge of the folklore and legends has just progressed so much. But one of my favorite things about researching this topic is that over the years, Kevin and I would call one another and say, man, I just found a story of a dog turning Wendigo. Have you ever heard that? Or, you know, I just discovered an infant turning Wendigo. Or have you heard of a black dog being a spy for the Wendigo? So all these new things we were digging up over this 20-year process really kept us going. And it was a learning process that's still continuing to this day.
I mean, were you surprised when you started? Because obviously I know you refer to the level of research and the time it's taken you both to pull this incredible collection together, gentlemen. Would you say that you have surprised yourself at just how much information is out there that seems to have been overlooked or perhaps neglected in both a monstrous sense, but also in regards to the history of folklore in the northern United States and Canada? Do you think it's been neglected for whatever reason?
I certainly think it has. And Chad can attest to this, I'm sure. One of the things that we encountered in our research is so much of the academic research is completely focused on the Wendigo psychosis side, which is just the cannibalistic human being. Mm. Because, you know, most, I guess, serious researchers that might consider themselves, you know, they don't want to research monsters. They don't want to research spirits and ghosts. So naturally, they're going to focus in on what they believe to be real. And that's these people that are documented cannibals. And so they really zero it in on just that one slice of the phenomena. And the vast majority of Wendigo research is out there, and there's some really good stuff, but it really only focuses on that. They completely ignore the folklore. They completely ignore the supernatural side of it. You know, in the worst cases, they kind of, you know, I don't want to say ridicule, but kind of look down upon some of the beliefs of the native peoples, you know, thinking, oh, you know, they're just superstitious. And it's like, well, you know, they've been recording and talking about these things happening for hundreds and hundreds of years. You know, to be that dismissive about an entire belief system, I thought was kind of disrespectful, number one. But number two, I think it needed to be addressed and it needed to be written about.
I think the irony of this legend is that there's a ton of stuff already out there. But all of that stuff that's out there comes from the form of sociologists, anthropologists, and the like, who are looking at the legend through the lens of, was the Wendigo really a metaphor for the Canadian's government cracking down on the First Nation people, or the changing role of a woman in the marriage of a First Nation family, or those veins of research. So there's a ton out there. You can read academic journal after academic journal on that. But the irony is, on the flip side, there was virtually nothing about the supernatural aspect of it, the flesh and blood creature or the shamans fighting these creatures. So that was a bit interesting, is that you could read for years of all the research done on the Wendigo and never come away with anything paranormal or supernatural. It's as though they wanted nothing to do with that. So that was the goal of our book, to try to avoid what's already been done and not try to explain it away as what Kevin and I call white-splaining, that 400 years later, those of us in Western culture, well, we know better than the First Nation people, those primitive savages, that we can explain what they were dealing with because we're much more intelligent. And we avoided that completely and took these legends and took these accounts at face value.
Yeah, I mean, it is a very interesting aspect to that, because I completely got where you guys were coming from in regards to sort of shining a light on this without preconceived bias that I think, as you refer to there, Chad, a lot of people have tried to explain it away as an ignorant interpretation of cultural change, or use the Wendigo as a metaphor for enslavement or the fight for survival for the tribes in the particular areas. So I think that is one of the stronger aspects of the book, is that there doesn't seem to be any sort of facet of the Wendigo legend that you two have shied away from. You've basically embraced everything that the native cultures have been able to offer you in regards to their versions of the Wendigo. So I've found it very interesting that the Wendigo psychosis kind of explanation is always blamed on, well, these people lived in very harsh environments in Canada, and obviously the winters are extremely difficult and dangerous for these people. Yet we, in other areas of the world, such as Scandinavia and Russia, where you have a very similar kind of climate, there seems to be a very little kind of comparative legend or lore that could explain away this psychosis, because for someone like me, gentlemen, surely if they're blaming the environment for the creation of the Wendigo, we should be able to look at other areas of the world where these same beliefs would exist, and there seems to be nothing comparable in European Arctic areas.
And Paul, let me just backstep here for a second, and you make a great point there, but I want to make sure that the listeners who may not be familiar with Wendigo psychosis get a good idea of what it is that we're talking about here. And Wendigo psychosis is thought to be a mental disorder. It's not listed in the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, which is really the Bible for mental health professionals, but it would fall under a category of a culture-bound syndrome, meaning that it seems to affect people within a specific culture or segment of society. And it's a compulsion, including violence and depression and a desire for human flesh, that sometimes even went into cannibalism. So it's thought as a mental disorder that people were suffering from. And it dates back to the 1920s and 1930s, where the idea first came up. And if you read a lot of the newspaper accounts of that time, they're blatantly racist, that they equate the Wendigo with devil worship, and that these primitive savages are out there believing in it. So they came up with this idea that it couldn't possibly be real. How can we explain it? Well, they must be mentally ill.
Very true. I mean, that is a very interesting aspect, as you touch on there as well, because some of the early reports in the newspaper articles that you've included in the book, there is a very strong colonial element to them, gentlemen, in regards to the, as you refer to, these seem to be uneducated savages with these peculiar and outdated beliefs, and therefore we need to educate these people and prove that they're just being stupid, essentially.
Yeah. And what we found in our research is that, you know, a lot of that, those assumptions aren't entirely accurate. There's plenty of 100-year-old plus documented accounts of of white settlers and fur trappers and explorers encountering similar things. You know, were they as ignorant or were they as backwards? You know, are we going to judge them by the same measure? You know, there's plenty of accounts where they're describing people physically changing into monstrous creatures. And, you know, and these are documented. I mean, part of the reason that they kind of blow off a lot of the native stories is just because that their stories, they're oral traditions. They weren't documented. They weren't written down. So a lot of academia, you know, if you didn't write it down, it didn't happen. You know, they kind of approach it like that. But, you know, these were written down in the journals of settlers and some of the first white people to arrive in the area. They're encountering these really strange things as well, but those are kind of conveniently ignored.
It's incredible, really, because as you've both mentioned, it seems as though people were scared to dive into the full version of the Wendigo and simply try to pigeonhole it, as you refer to, as this psychosis, this mental illness. But then again, it's a very specific set of responses in regards to what's classed as Wendigo psychosis, because cannibalism is a very peculiar trait in any culture, regardless, and it's often viewed very, you know, quite rightly, very negatively. And yet here we have one particular branch of native folklore which specifies that cannibalism seems to be the final act or the final appetite of the transformation, be it however the poor victim has turned Wendigo. Because there is also a variety of ways that a person could become a Wendigo, isn't there?
Yes. So, you know, to your point, that's a cultural feature that you can find around the world regarding cannibalism. You know, like every culture in the world virtually finds it abhorrent eating their own. And, you know, and some tribal cultures find convenient ways of kind of getting around that by looking at, you know, rival tribes as being less human. You know, it's that kind of division of how we define humanity. You know, if you strip someone else of being human, then suddenly they're the animal, then it's okay to eat them or butcher them. You know, so you see that, you know, in you used to see in places like Papua New Guinea, but within a particular society worldwide, it's abhorrent. You know, it's one of those things that keeps society together, you know, one of those ultimate taboos. So once you cross that threshold, you know, in almost every society, it's a point of no return, barring a few extreme cases where people can argue that they literally had no choice. But usually that's only with eating the dead, not actually killing someone to eat them. So, you know, we had that here in the Jamestown case in early American history, you know, where they had to eat some of the recently dead just to survive. And so people can kind of explain away that as like, well, you know, you had to do what you had to do, but at least they weren't murdering people. So it is a cultural feature. You're right. It gets very touchy. People get emotional about it, and it's gruesome. And it's understandable why a lot of people kind of shy away from it, even from a research standpoint.
I mean, the thing I've taken from your book, gentlemen, is the level of brutality, especially in dealing with people that have become Wendigo, is quite horrific in certain cases. You know, we're talking about decapitations and the complete dismemberment of certain people and the burning of corpses and the removing of organs. So, not that I'm particularly squeamish, but I have to say it took me back to read some of the reports and the witness accounts of what happened. And once you dove into this, were you surprised at some of the levels of violence that you stumbled across and uncovered, or was it something that you were kind of expecting to discover in regards to this vicious creature?
One thing that a lot of researchers and academia propose is that the Wendigo was an escape goat that Native and First Nation people often wanted to get rid of their old, their sick, and those who weren't contributing to society, that were a drain on limited resources, so that they could kill them, but say, wait, it wasn't my fault. We had to do this. It absolves them of the guilt of killing their loved ones by blaming it on they were turning Wendigo. So we were a little bit prepared for the gruesomeness, but I think the gruesomeness came out of a huge fear, a genuine, terrifying fear of the Wendigo. It wasn't out of brutality. It wasn't out of anger that they did these things. I'll give you a quick example of how afraid they were of people turning Wendigo. There's a case up in Lesser Slave Lake in Alberta, Canada, a few miles north of Edmonton, and it involves a man named Moostoos. And in 1899, he began turning Wendigo, as they called it, or going Wendigo. And they tried to cure him. They spent many days and nights with the best shamans practicing their best medicine on him. And it didn't work. He kept saying, if you don't kill me, I'm going to consume and kill all of you. So finally, they could take it no longer. And several people hit him with an axe in the chest, killing him by all accounts. But that wasn't enough for them. They took it even further because they were afraid that once they killed him, he'd simply rise up and come back as the Wendigo and get revenge. So they then drove a stake through the axe hole and put him pinned to the ground. Just in case he tried to rise up, he wouldn't be able to physically. Hmm. But that wasn't enough. So later in the evening, they took out that pin that they pinned him to the ground with and poured hot tea down the hole in his chest so it would defrost his icy heart and he would die as a Wendigo. Hmm. But that didn't even do it for them. They then tied his legs down, chained him to the ground, and watched him for several hours to make sure he wouldn't rise up again. And then just before daylight, as another added precaution, they decapitated him just to be sure that he would not come back. That's the level of fear that they had about a Wendigo. And again, it wasn't done out of anger or revenge. It was done out of love so that person would not turn into a Wendigo and harm their friends and loved ones.
And so, you know, a lot of this stuff, I agree with Chad, you know, it wasn't so much that the brutality level surprised us. Because you see very similar things in vampire lore. You know, in Transylvanian villages, they would dig up a loved one, put a stake through their chest, sometimes cut out their heart and burn it, and the entire village will put the ashes into a tea and drink it as a form of inoculation against vampirism. So it's, you know, this kind of stuff isn't necessarily anything new. But what we were surprised about is just how widespread it was. When we first started doing this research, you know, we were expecting to maybe find a dozen cases or 20, you know, that we could document and refer to. But the more that we dug, the more that we realized that, you know, we were finding hundreds of cases that, and these weren't just over a short period of time. It's not like it was a mass hysteria or a craze that just kind of swept through and then faded away. You know, this is spanning hundreds of years where people are doing these same actions and having the same behavior. So I think it was the scale of it that surprised us more than anything.
Yes, very much so. I mean, that's a good point in regards to the comparison, because obviously the vampire, the way to deal with those potential creatures is very similar. It seems to me, as you say, there is a real, as strangely as it may sound, there is a real fear enwrapped inside a love and protection, because the other interesting aspect, obviously, about the Wendigo is these people didn't attack strangers that or just go into the woods and attack anybody they came across. They tended to go after their most beloved or the people they were closest to, which is a very interesting aspect to this, because if anything, it should be the opposite. You would expect them to kind of be repulsed by this attraction to killing the ones that they care the most for.
And that's why you find in the literature so many of them that knew they were turning or felt that they were going Wendigo. They actually begged to be killed because they would rather die than to turn into this monster where they would harm the people closest to them. So you have case after case of people begging to be put out of their misery, so to speak, so that they would not turn and do these sinister deeds, that they knew what was coming. And they feared that more than death.
Yes, it is incredible because, like I say, there are so many cases where the victim, it's almost as if they, and as you refer to in the book, there seems to be a variety of symptoms that come to these people. A lot of them mention that they feel like they're freezing from the inside out, which I found as a very interesting aspect, both physically and mentally, to the potential victim that's turning. Did you find that interesting, that in the majority of cases, there seems to be a lot of people that claim that their hearts seem to be turning to ice, or they could feel their bones icing up. Was that a very interesting aspect? Because I know it's not all of the particular cases, but there seems to be quite a lot where that's reported.
Yes, that's a reoccurring feature throughout all of Wendigo lore. And it basically starts with the spirit version of the Wendigo, which is seen as almost the embodiment of winter, or like it's the spirit is representative of ice and winter storms and cold. And so when it invades you, it brings that element with it. And so one of the side effects, or one of the first onsets of Wendigo possession, is the victim, they will say that they're freezing on the inside, that their heart is turning to ice. And it's believed that once they have completely metamorphosed into a full-fledged monstrous Wendigo, that the heart at that point is completely frozen or encased in ice. And again, the only way to kill it at that point is to melt the icy heart and destroy it. So this whole theme of ice and cold in this very elemental aspect, which again ties into the very environment in which these things live, and particularly in the wintertime, that's one of the symptoms that they talk about. And when Wendigos have been killed in a lot of cases, even the people that have been the Wendigo hunters have described, once they dissect this person or basically open this person up, you know, they find that the heart is encased in ice. Sometimes they describe ice or frost that has grown along the spinal column. But a case after case, they keep reporting these similar things of ice forming in the chest cavity of these victims. And Chad and I, you know, we were so perplexed by that because it would happen again and again and again. And it's so bizarre because, of course, you know, we don't know of any kind of rational scientific reason for this. Or so we even looked at a medical explanation, you know, were people, you know, was there some kind of ailment or parasite or some kind of disease that people had that when they were opened up and examined, you know, had the look of ice, you know, like, is it, you know, some kind of growth? Or perhaps maybe the Ojibwe or Cree term for ice had a double meaning for something like cancer or, you know, something like that. We pursued every kind of avenue that we could to figure out, you know, when they're saying that there's ice in the chest of this person, you know, what do they actually mean by that? And we couldn't turn up anything other than just basically taking them at their word. You know, when they say that this person's chest cavity was filled with ice, we just have to believe them.
Yeah, and I mean, that's an interesting aspect because obviously, as you both referred to, the academics would always try and explain this as a form of psychosis. Yet, it was the people that were dealing with the person suffering the psychosis that would report these symptoms. So that was also a very interesting aspect, because I think that's a fair point, Kevin, where you perhaps when you look at it on face value, is it a way of explaining illness or something such as cancer or some kind of infection that would cause a problem in the chest area? But clearly that's not what was happening. This was a very strong belief, and that's obviously one of the aspects about that I found interesting, was the way that they would try to cure these people, primarily by using heat and hot tallow, which was not something I was that aware of before I read your book. So I found that very interesting, that there seemed to be a list of symptoms, but also a prescribed way of attempting to try and rectify this change before it went too far, which also, I think, takes away the aspects that some people try to explain that this was just a cultural way of dealing with problems in the tribe or whatever. Because clearly, if they just wanted rid of these people, they would not attempt to cure them, surely.
And there were many warning signs of a person going Wendigo. Oftentimes, not only would that person complain of coldness or freezing on the innards of their body, but they would also start having hallucinations where they would see their friends and family, not as loved ones, but as tasty prey animals, game animals. They would see their loved one walk in and they would think it was a tasty beaver or a moose. They would literally hallucinate and see them as that. And there'd be a lot of groaning and calling out. They would become quiet and withdrawn. They'd have abrupt personality changes. They would often withdraw from the tribe and go on their own. They would have apathy. They'd be depressed. And there were physical changes as well. Many of them would start to swell up. up and get bigger. And their faces took on a grotesque manner to them as well. And that's when they started looking at curing these people, because it was said that once you turned Wendigo fully, wherever that line was, which was very hard to determine, that the only way to then cure you was through death. But until then, you could do hot tallow, which again is a rendered fat that you could get from a bear or moose or any game animal. And if you poured that down the throat of a suspected Wendigo, it would defrost its icy heart and it would be cured. And, you know, others look at it as if you're starving to death and you get this big influx of fat and calories, that maybe that will heal you as well. But there are other cases where religious leaders could cure somebody. If they went to the local missionary and set up at the chapels, that oftentimes just being told that they were cured of the Wendigo would work for them. Shamans could cure and fight a Wendigo and cure the person suspected. There's an infamous case of Jack Fiddler, who's known as perhaps the greatest or at least the best at killing Wendigos back in the 1800s and early 1900s. There's a story that his family passed down through the generations of a man claiming he was turning Wendigo, and he was in his shelter and refusing to come out and threatening people. So Jack Fiddler, the Wendigo hunter, simply went over to him and started picking him up, throwing him on the ground and whipping him, saying that if you turn Wendigo, I'm going to kill you. I'm a powerful enough shaman. I can do it. You do not want to turn Wendigo or it will cost you your life. And by all counts, that worked. It cured the guy. He said, you know, enough, I'm not going to be killed. And whatever went on, he was cured just simply by someone in a position of power letting him know that it would be okay and that you'd be cured.
I mean, there's a wonderful headline you use in the book, which says, which refers to exorcism tried in vain, axe supplanted medicine, which really made me chuckle. And there's several of these, and like you say, it is very interesting as well, this belief in certain members of tribes were designated as Wendigo killers. Did you find that most tribes had that kind of belief, or was it specific to certain tribes in certain territories?
Yeah. So what we found is that it was interesting, because oftentimes a shaman would be the one, or the chief of the tribe would be the one to do the execution or the putting out of their misery or the Wendigo killing, however you looked at it. But oftentimes that deed fell upon a family member of the person that was turning Wendigo. And that was done mostly to stop any retaliation from someone who thought it was not a just killing. That if it was a family member who did it, there wouldn't be as much pressure to retaliate as if it was someone not as close to the victim. But oftentimes shamans would be put in place, or the Wendigo hunter. And a lot of these Wendigo hunters, like Jack Fiddler, had a reputation throughout the entire region as being a very powerful shaman, someone you would not want to mess with because they were so powerful. But oftentimes the entire tribe would welcome this killing or approve of it, because they felt if this person was not taken care of, that it would spread to the entire community or the entire tribe and everybody would be infected, so that it was just something that had to be done.
I mean, that often as well is a very interesting aspect of it. Like you say, that it's usually designated to a close relative or a loved member of the family that would deal with this. And that's an interesting aspect that I'd not really considered, Chad, that clearly that would remove any potential, because like you say, I'm sure it would be easy to label someone you had a disagreement with, perhaps, as they were changing into a Wendigo, and therefore you could cause some kind of conflict by basically accusing people of things that simply weren't true. So that, I suppose, once again takes away from this kind of aspect that it was done just to get rid of people, because clearly if that was the case, it would be used as a weapon towards your enemies, would it not?
That's exactly right. And that's, in fact, that's how those kind of accusations were levied in the Salem witch trials, because some of the women that were accused of witchcraft were wealthy landowners. And it was unusual because they were widows. It was unusual for women to own that much land or have that much power. And so other men that basically wanted their land found it really convenient to just accuse them of witchcraft. And then they were dispatched and their lands were divvied up. So, you know, it is a very convenient way of just kind of pointing the finger at someone and saying, you know, you're a witch or you're a Wendigo. Let's take you out and get you out of the way so that I can get what I want. So it was kind of a, like, as Chad said, it was a cultural way of kind of diffusing that whole contention right from the beginning.
There isn't that aspect of it only being women that would be accused, because off the Salem witch trials is a prime example of there's some clear sexism going on in that particular aspect. And I know you both refer to it in the book about it's very interesting that the death count at Salem is quite low in comparison to what's gone in the history of the Wendigo. And I found that very interesting that most of the cases seem to be men that were changing into this. So once again, it seems to go against these kind of preconceived ideas of people being labelled witches or possessed or consorting with the fey folk that you often see in different cultures.
Yeah, it seemed pretty indiscriminate on who was possessed. I mean, there's a lot of cases of men, as Chad pointed out. There's cases of animals turning Wendigo, even babies, which, you know, when people that point at the whole psychological aspect of it, you know, you can argue that adults or even adolescents, you know, could kind of lose their mind and behave strangely. But like an infant having the same kind of behavior that it would be impossible for it to be taught or imprinted, you know, especially with animals, you know, it's like, how do you explain that? But what's interesting in the Wendigo lore is the female Wendigos were seen as the most dangerous of all. Because in Ojibwe and Cree culture, number one, age was seen as a sign of power. You know, the older someone is.
Welcome to Kraken Mare, the biggest liquid hydrocarbon ocean on Saturn's moon Titan.
And this is just one of the places you get to visit and learn about when you listen to the Hostile Worlds podcast.
The Hostile Worlds podcast, which is, of course, a science-based audio drama documentary series that teaches you all about our universe in a fun and entertaining way.
Head on over to hostileworlds.net to subscribe on your podcast app of choice.
The more wise they are, the more knowledgeable they are. And in the case of a shaman, you know, they've increased in power. And with women, they had a lot of power, but they didn't, it wasn't publicly known. It was kind of hidden. Like they weren't, it wasn't really accepted for women to discuss what kind of connection they had to the spirit world or what kind of spirit allies that they had. So they kept it to themselves. And because they did, no one knew who their spirit allies were. So women were seen as far, far more dangerous than men because they just had no way of gauging what their power was. Whereas, you know, men would perhaps boast about it or talk about it all the time. Mm. So older women especially were seen as by far the most fearful Wendigos of all.
Yeah, that's a very interesting aspect to the whole phenomenon. As well, like I said, the other aspect of this is I've learned so much about native and tribe folklore because it's something I've wanted to learn a lot more about, because other than perhaps a couple of well-known things that have crossed over into popular culture, it's very interesting to learn about the whole folklore and belief system of some of these tribes. So I think that's a really enjoyable and interesting aspect of this whole project that you've brought to us, because it's showing people like myself a great deal of information about things that perhaps do not get the respect and the level of discussion or writing in regards to these belief structures and how the tribes viewed themselves in the world at that time.
And it varied quite a bit as well, that in northern Minnesota up by the Canadian border, the Wendigo was seen much more as a harbinger of death, a death omen, that if it was coming or if you heard it or if you saw it, it meant you or someone you knew was going to die very shortly. Very similar to hearing the Irish Banshee and other death omens. Mm. But it was very prevalent in that area, more so than anywhere else. And it was also up in that area where they feared building snowmen in the winter because they were afraid that it would turn into a Wendigo or invite the Wendigo to that community. Mm. So you had these little pockets where the belief was a little bit different. It really skewed a little bit off from the general belief, and that was fascinating to learn as well.
It's one of those things, Chad, that I've always been very surprised that why only the Skinwalker and the Thunderbird, for example, seem to be the two most popular that most people without much knowledge of Native American and First Nations tribes seem to be aware of. And yet you do a wonderful roundup in the book in one of the latter chapters where you look at a variety of different creatures, most of which, with the greatest of respect, I'd never heard of at all. So did you come across anything else that surprised you that was entwined in the Wendigo lore rather than just it being a standalone belief?
Yeah, like in that latter chapter of the book where we kind of run down other creatures that are similar to the Wendigo, at least for me, I think the interesting thing is finding the commonalities between some of those things. For instance, there's a Iroquois legend of a creature that they referred to as the Stone Coats, which were these creatures that had this very hard stone-like skin. They were these cannibalistic giants that lived in the woods and if they were still enough, they could sometimes disguise themselves as a pile of boulders and things like that. And one of the things about in Wendigo lore is they say that, you know, when a creature becomes a full-fledged Wendigo, that it's, you know, encased in ice, that it's this icy creature, and it's so much harder to kill because if you shoot at it with arrows or bullets or whatever, it seems impenetrable because of its hard, icy structure. And you see the same thing with the Stone Coats. You know, it's like a regional variant of the Wendigo theme. They both are cannibals. They're both are giants. They both have these hard skins that are impenetrable to arrows. You know, what it does, at least from a research standpoint, is it really shows you how far these belief systems have traveled. Or
you just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Over the years and just how widespread they are. You know, they're not just these little pockets of belief, but there has been these cultural interactions over a very, very large part of North America where there's been these cultural interactions where they've been spreading their belief systems, their folklore, their traditions. Every region has like kind of their own version or their own way of kind of coloring those legends. And I just found that so fascinating, just how these different regions kind of retell their own stories, you know. And I don't know if it's so much of like a telephone game, you know, every time you retell the story, you know, someone adds a little bit of embellishment to it until it kind of changes in a different direction, or if it's just everyone experiencing the same phenomena, but just having a slightly different interpretation of it. You know, just as if you have like a car accident or some kind of crime scene, you ask 12 witnesses what they saw, and you're probably going to get 8 to 12 different answers of what exactly went on. So,
and I was really fascinated by a lot of the lore seems to be very similar to the old trickster lore or the skinwalker lore, that the Wendigo, by most accounts, was a very large creature when it was in flesh and blood, anywhere from 8 feet tall to higher than the treetops. Mm. And it could get as big as it wanted. It could also shapeshift, according to a lot of the early lore, and it often would take on the form of an owl, that owls were seen as very suspicious, that they were either the Wendigo shapeshifted to get a spy on the community or the tribe, or the owl was in cahoots with the Wendigo, acting as a spy for the Wendigo. And we also found a couple stories where tribes were very suspicious when a black dog would come into the community because they thought that was the Wendigo in a shape-shifting form. So I really thought it was so fascinating that you have all these trickster aspects to it, shape-shifting and the like.
Yeah, I know there's an interesting aspect as well where you look at the cultural changes that the Wendigo seems to be undergoing as well, because I know the mimicry aspect seems to be quite a modern addition to the legend, does it not?
That's right. That's one of the things that the difficulties of the book was kind of separating what a Wendigo is traditionally versus what it has become today. You know, anyone, if they Google Wendigo and select images, you're guaranteed to get a whole page full of these images of this creature with antlers and an elk skull. And it has more of a look of sort of a Northwoods elemental creature, or this kind of undead kind of thing. And that's really a relatively modern invention. It's not exactly traditional. And I think that gets back to what I was saying before, where people just had this concept of what a Wendigo was without really understanding the cultural or traditional history behind it. And so they kind of filled in the gaps creatively, you know, for right or wrong, I'm not really judging here, creatively on their own to kind of fill in those gaps and literally put flesh on the bones of this creature so that they could kind of define it enough to, you know, create an image of it. So, you know, in the book, I trace the antler motif back to about the 1940s or so, some of the artwork that was done in Weird Tales and some of those pulp magazines, which was kind of clearly based on the Cernunnos legend, which is more European, because of course the artist was a white guy and was of European descent. And so he was kind of looking at it as this woodland god, in a sense, you know, sort of like Cernunnos is, you know, this, which is typically viewed as this antlered masculine master of the hunt kind of figure. And so, you know, kind of just adapted it to that. And since then, it's just kind of grown and grown. And you brought up the mimicry aspect. That's not really a part of the original Wendigo lore. In the original lore, Wendigos, they made sounds, but they weren't really viewed, once they're in their fully monstrous form, they weren't really viewed as being highly intelligent or possessing a high amount of cunning. They were seen more as like just flat out monsters. In some of the more fable like stories, you'll have them, you know, having conversations and talking to animals and things like that. But those are more fables type. But traditionally, mostly Wendigo, the only thing that they do is create a paralyzing wail. You know, it's this very beast-like sound that's not really indicative of it, of any amount of high intelligence. They scream and wail. That people describe it as sounding like this wind gale coming through their village, and people that hear it are sometimes paralyzed and fixed to the spot, where then the Wendigo comes in and snatches people up, and you know, for eating later, and they're unable to run away. So the mimicry thing is. You find it again and again and again in a lot of modern urban legends, because it is a creepy thing. You know, you're out in the woods or someplace that you're not familiar with, and you hear the voice of someone that you know or someone that you recognize. They sound like they're asking for help or they're in distress. And so naturally you go running in that direction. It's a lure. But that's not really part of the Wendigo tradition if you go way back and look at the actual documented reports. So I think that's just a way of modern culture and modern folklore and urban legends kind of making a foothold into the evolution of the Wendigo legend.
It does. It worms its way into the lore. For the ability to mimic, I received a report recently from a gentleman who said he was out hunting with his buddy, and they were far apart. And all of a sudden, the forest went eerily quiet, as it always seems to do when paranormal things are afoot. And he got this sense that he wasn't alone, that something was there, almost this zone of fear that he was in. And that's when he heard his friend calling out for him. And his friend called out for him. He started walking in that direction. And suddenly the friend called out in the other direction, and he became confused. And finally, after a long time, he eventually found his buddy and said, "Why were you calling out for me? Are you in harm? Did something happen?" And his friend said, "I didn't utter a word this entire time." And the man never saw anything. He never caught a glimpse of anything. But just because he thought that his friend was calling out and something was mimicking it, he thought he had encountered the Wendigo. So sometimes pop culture then feeds more sightings.
Yeah, it's very interesting. I mean, the other aspect that I have nothing but respect for you two, because quite often, most people, when they're researching a book, gentlemen, will usually do it through the summer. So I have to say, I was absolutely astounded by your trip to Lake Wendigo and Star Island. Primarily, Kevin, I do not know how you slept outside in a hammock, sir. That is incredible. That alone shows the level of passion you two clearly had for this subject. Did you expect to push yourself as much as you did physically in regards to tracking this beast down?
Well, Chad and I kind of pride ourselves on being field researchers foremost. Mm. You know, we spend a lot of time in archives and libraries and on the internet and poring over books and things. But our favorite thing is to really be in the field at these actual places, interviewing people that live in these regions. I mean, that's the core of who we are and the brand of research that we do. You know, we feel that we can't really write about something unless we've actually been there. You know, unless we can say from firsthand experience, you know, we can describe the environment, we can talk about the feeling and the impressions that we got being there. Because, you know, I'm a student of you know, more arcane systems and stuff and things like psychogeography, and I do feel that really getting a sense of a place adds to your understanding of what it is you're researching. And so much of this lore is really tied to the land and the places that it originates. So in regards to Wendigo Island in the winter time, it probably wasn't the brightest thing that Chad and I have ever done. I think we were a little unprepared for just how severe the winter conditions actually got. I'll be the first to admit, I think we got a little lucky. Mm. You know, I sleep in my hammock when I'm out in the wilderness a lot, but I'll fully admit I did not expect it to get to 13 below zero that night. So I think a lot of it was just a little bit of luck on our part.
And so Lake Wendigo is up in the Northwoods of Minnesota, just east of Bemidji, and it's a lake on an island in a lake, which makes it kind of an anomaly in its own right. And they believe the Wendigo inhabits the lake, and that anyone walking along the shoreline, the Wendigo will snatch you and pull you under, and you'll meet your watery grave. And they've found footprints in the ice in the winter, these large holes in the ice with giant footprints coming out of the ice, walking to the island. And Kevin was right that we weren't anticipating that a wind chill would get 30 degrees below zero Fahrenheit. And I remember that the night of the expedition, when we first got there, I let my excitement really take over, that even though we were head to toe covered in snow gear, we spent the entire day scouring the island, getting our base camp set up. And as nightfall came, we had snow all over ourselves, and I remember I was so excited to get to our fire and to get our hot tallow going over the fire that, you know, I didn't even realize that a lot of my clothes in the inside and outside were becoming very wet. And so I had two options at that point, because it had defrosted so much by the fire, that I could then just go to bed in my sleeping bag and let my clothes kind of freeze up into thick board, like wearing it ice sheets, or I could quickly strip down and try to put on new clothing. Even though it was cold, it was warm dry clothing. Mm. So I opted for the changing out of my clothes, and I got down to my underwear and I thought to myself, I'm in real danger here. If I don't get in my new clothes and into my bag very quickly, I'm going to have to go just sleep by the fire and stay up all night because I'll freeze to death, because we were a good 4-hour walk just to the nearest, in the daytime that is, just to the nearest place of help or rescue. And it was a rookie mistake, and that's one thing you learn on every expedition. No matter if you've been doing it 6 months or 30 years, you always learn something. And for me, on Windigo Lake, I learned you really need to slow down and plan out your decisions and try not to let your excitement get the best of you, because we were running around like chickens thinking, this is so awesome, we're on Windigo Lake, this is amazing, we'll try to conjure up the Windigo tonight. And you really start to disregard your surroundings. But I think it gave us a perfect illustration of how dangerous times were back when this was the norm.
Very much so. I mean, it is a compelling aspect of the book, is that particular expedition. And I mean, the other aspect of this as well is, and I'm not being churlish when I say this, the supernatural belief system and folklore of the Wendigo, you're basically putting yourself out there as a temptation, because God forbid if something had happened either through the environment or you stumbled across a physical embodiment of this, that's a real risk you were taking by even if you didn't really believe in the whole mythos of the Wendigo. It's a hell of a way to tempt fate, gents.
it certainly is. You know, Chet and I, we consider ourselves open-minded skeptics. You know, like when we did this book, we didn't come in it from the point of view of believers. You know, neither one of us has had any kind of firsthand, you know, experience or sighting of a Wendigo. So it's not like we were trying to prove anything existence-wise. You know, we'd rather the readers just read the material and make up their own decision whether, you know, of what level of reality this legend has. But, you know, to your point, you know, that weekend on Wendigo Island, one of the things, I guess I was kind of bait for whatever this thing is. Like, one of the things that I had done ahead of time is I was doing a little bit of a fast leading up to that weekend, and I was only eating jerky, just eating strictly meat the whole time, thinking that, like, maybe I could get a head start on this whole cannibal possession thing, so that if it was going to possess anyone, I'd make it perhaps a little easier for it. But fortunately for Chad and our other explorer Noah, that didn't happen. But they did have axes nearby, so if I had to be dispatched, they probably could have done it.
But we joke a bit about, you know, that next morning in the minus 30 degree weather, going out and checking on Kevin and thinking that, you know, he was frozen to death and we'd have to leave him there as an offering for the Wendigo. But we joke about that. But in a lot of communities and cultures, they are even afraid to mention the name, to say the name of the Wendigo, because it's their belief that when you say the name, it puts you on the radar of this creature, that it now knows you know. That when you go looking for the weird, sometimes the weird will come looking for you. I was doing a program on Minnesota creatures of the Northwoods, and I was up on near tribal land, and I was going to talk about the Wendigo. And before my program, several elders from the local tribe came up to me and said, "We hear that you're going to be talking about a certain creature that is known throughout the area. We would appreciate it if you would not talk about it." And they wouldn't even say the name, but I knew exactly they were talking about the Wendigo. So I said, "Sure, I'll chuck it right from my program. Don't worry." And the words no more than left my mouth when I could see the physical relaxation of these tribe members, that all of a sudden they became much more relaxed and calmed down, that they were really truly afraid that just by talking about it was enough to draw it out and bring it to the community.
And I mean, that also shows us that here we are in the 21st century, and clearly the belief in this creature is still ingrained in tribespeople, and it's not something that you can pass off as old-fashioned superstition or a lack of education. These people are smack bang in the middle of modern society, Chad. It's still ingrained in them. They still have this overriding sense of fear and the belief that they do not want to even be flippant about this creature still.
I spoke with a woman after one of my lectures. She was in her 80s, and she grew up and was raised and lived her whole life near the Canadian border. And she recalled, as a young girl, playing with all the other kids in the community, her father used to tell her and all the other children that if you ever heard a kettle being struck out in the woods, that meant you needed to run home as fast as you could, because that was the Wendigo striking its kettle and it was coming after you. Mm. And she told me that she never heard that kettle as a kid, but now, more than 70 years later, she still listens for that kettle in the woods. That story had stuck with her so many times and for so many years. And this was a well-educated, she was non-native. So these stories do have a lot of importance for people, that they would keep it with them for seven decades.
Yeah, it's very interesting as well, because I suppose you could be quite flippant about this belief that even mentioning it would encourage it to visit you, like you say, because once you know, it knows you know. But I did find a very interesting part of the book where there's a reference to alcohol. It seems to be aware of or attracted to alcohol. Did you come across anything else in regards to your research, gentlemen, where you came across things that may cause the Wendigo to arrive other than talking about it or this strange reference to alcohol?
Great question. Kevin, I think you did a lot on shamans summoning it.
Yes. So one of the things, you know, like typically in almost all the legends, it's the Wendigo is attracted to people. Either they were just born with the Wendigo being their sort of natural spirit, that kind of the way that the Ojibwe and Cree believe is that they believe that everyone is born with what they call a powagon, which is a spirit form. And usually it's the spirit of a certain animal, or sometimes it's the spirit of a trickster or a hero in their mythology. Mm. But sometimes it's for the more unfortunate people, and they can't control this. It just is what it is. It's kind of just, you know, luck of the draw. Sometimes it's some of the more formidable and darker elements of their folklore, like the Wendigo. And so some people, their spirit guide, if you want to even call it a guide, is the Wendigo. So there's certain people that have a predilection for going Wendigo that's higher than others, because it's naturally just a part of them, or that, at least that's how it's viewed. But other than like in those scenarios or starvation settings where people are in a weakened state and make themselves vulnerable, as Chad said, the other way that a Wendigo can basically be brought to someone or summoned is through magical warfare between shamans. So one of the things that we discovered is that shamans, if they have a rival, like another shaman, or even just someone that they want to get back at or you know, take out, they can summon the Wendigo spirit to attack them through magical control. And there was a number of cases in the book where shamans were, for whatever reason, you know, they wanted to marry someone's daughter or whatever, and they were rebuffed or refused, either because they already had enough wives, or because the woman was already betrothed to someone else, or they were too young, what have you. And some of the shamans, because, you know, they were seen as powerful elders, would take this as a personal slight, and they would summon the Wendigo after these families. And so there was a number of cases where the young, unfortunate woman who was the target would either become Wendigo, or her betrothed would become Wendigo, or someone else in the family, that you'd become a disaster for that family. And then there's cases where shamans would battle each other. They would send Wendigo spirits at one another, and they could either try to possess them, or the Wendigo could scare away all the game from the village in which the shaman was living And it was, the end result was similar, but it was more of a long and protracted process, you know, where by scaring away the game from this village, it would cause the village to go into a state of slow starvation because their hunting was failing again and again. And then once starvation sets in, then that's ample setting for the Wendigo to possess somebody.
Yes, very much. It is a really interesting phenomena. I've just found it such a thoroughly interesting book, and I know I've mentioned it to you off air as well, that I absolutely loved it. I think it's one of those books that the rare thing about it is I could read more and more of it. It's phenomenal, and it's given me a real thirst in regards to the subject. It would be remiss of me to, before I let you go, gentlemen, to not touch on probably the most famous Wendigo case. And I think one of the aspects of your book is, I don't think this case is going to be seen in isolation anymore, because the Swift Runner case is obviously probably the most widely known alleged Wendigo story that most people who have a passing interest in the subject probably are aware of. Do you find it odd that that case, more than any other, seems to have crossed over? Or do you think it's simply a lack of knowledge and research into this subject and other such events? Because there are numerous ones that you touch on where, you know, there is a substantial body count in certain aspects. Do you think it was the case at that time that made it so famous? Or do you think it is a lack of knowledge?
Swift Runner, you're absolutely right that if people have heard something of the Wendigo, they probably heard of Swift Runner, and the newspapers called him the Indian that ate his family. And Swift Runner was a Cree trapper. He lived north of Edmonton in Alberta, Canada, and he lived in the 1870s, and it was in 1878 and 79, the winter of that season. Swift Runner was about 40 winters of age at that time, and oftentimes the tribe would stay together in the summer because game was plentiful and berries and food. But in the winter, they would spread out to increase their chances of finding game. So you'd get these family units that would go off in their own little pod, if you will. And Swift Runner took off with his wife, their six children, and his mother and his brother. And from the beginning, they had terrible time there. They got some game, but then Swift Runner fell ill, so his family broke up. Everyone left him except his oldest son, who refused to go anywhere without him. And he ended up, Swift Runner, going crazy from starvation and possession of the Wendigo, to the point where he ended up killing all of his family members, his wife and their children. His mother and brother wandered off into the woods on their own. And not only did he kill them, he started eating them. But the weird part was that he kept his youngest son alive for the entire winter, forcing him to eat his siblings and his mother. And I think what really resonates among people is not only the monstrous, sinister, gruesome details of it, that, you know, someone be so cruel to eat and kill their entire own family, but I think people like myself standing there with Kevin in the spot where Swift Runner did these dastardly deeds, putting ourselves in the position of that young son, the last survivor, had to have known that he was going to be next in line to be killed and eaten, but yet at the same time, he was trapped. There was nothing he could do. Couldn't fight his father. He couldn't flee. He would die of starvation. And I think that's what hit me the most. And that's when, after nearly 20 years of researching Swift Runner's story, that it all made sense, that what you were talking about is, how did Swift Runner's story break over into the general public when there are just as many tales of gruesome and gory stories? But I think it's that family breakage of the trust that really puts Swift Runner over the top. And that's what I think affected me the most, standing there in the woods, just knowing what had happened. That's the part that stuck with me the most out of this entire book, to the point where there are still nights I think about it here in Wisconsin and a cold chill comes over me. Just the brutal story of Swift Runner, and that the fact that when he was captured, he really thought he had done nothing wrong. He said, "Why should I be punished? I didn't kill anybody else's children. I just killed my own." And it's that kind of monstrosity where he said, you know, the Wendigo overtook me and I was no longer human. That's the scary part, because I think for a lot of people, they see that in other human beings. And that's the scary part, that perhaps the Wendigo is closer to all of us than we like to let on.
And just to kind of go off Chad's point, too, I think that's what makes this legend and this book in particular so much different than the other books that Chad and I have written. You know, we've written a number of books on folkloric creatures and various legends, but, you know, a lot of times those legends, you know, them as scary as they might be, usually don't involve, you know, the death of real people, or if so, you know, very few. You know, they're just these kind of dangerous things that some people believe are out there. But with the Wendigo story, it was very evident early on in our research that we had to take this a lot more seriously than the normal research, that it was a lot more delicate in a lot of ways, just because of the sheer amount of people that died. And this is all documented. These are real people that had real lives that were ended short because of this phenomena, whatever it is. And because of that, the whole legend had to be treated with a certain level of respect that we didn't necessarily have to apply to the other topics that we had written about in the past, just because you just didn't have that death count. I mean, it just takes it to a whole nother level.
Yeah, I have to say, it's one of those books where I'm reading some of the accounts, and I don't think I've read a book that's made me shake my head as much, you know, in just sheer disbelief, gentlemen, about some of the reports. And it is, like you say, I think it is that one of those subjects that you have to treat it with a real level of respect, not only because you touch on this at the beginning of the book about, did you feel it was appropriate for yourselves to be writing about this native subject? And therefore, you also had that balance to bring to it. But also, we're talking about brutal murders of people. You know, this is not a subject that you can treat with flippancy or disdain. You have to... There's a lot of baggage that comes when you delve into the Wendigo to the level that you two have.
And keep in mind that these cases and this research is what we were able to dig up. Kevin and I often talk about how much of the legend has simply been lost to history. Mm-hmm. That if we were around 100 years ago, I think we would have had a much better chance of preserving some of the old and original tales and folklore of the Wendigo, that we just, so much of it, Kevin often says, we're like supernatural archaeologists, that we're trying to piece together the puzzle with just fragments of it, that how much of it was out there that has been lost to history, how many unknown cases were taking place of the Wendigo that simply didn't have the fortunate luck of somebody being there to record it.
Is it, I mean, it's one of those aspects as well, gentlemen, I would imagine. I probably know the answer to this question before I ask you it, but I'm going to ask you it anyway. Have you found that since you've released the book, more information has started coming to you? Or, like I say, I know you refer a couple of times in the book that there was such a realm of information that you had, you could have probably written the book and made it four times as long, gents. So has that been something in regards to it's still developing and you're still uncovering things?
Certainly. I mean, the book has only been out since May, so it's still, you know, very new in many sense, but we're already getting a lot of contact from people that have read the book and are telling us their own stories. I mean, and these are our contemporary stories, you know, their own firsthand experiences of encountering what they believed to be the Wendigo, or they know of someone, you know, that did, or their family has a story that has been passed down. So it's really opened a lot of doors to avenues of research that we didn't know existed, you know, while writing this book. Ted and I often joke that, you know, this is just book one of the Wendigo story. And hopefully the volume two doesn't take 20 years to write, but you're absolutely right. You know, it's really open the door, and our hope is that it sheds some light on the whole legend, and that it also dispels some of the misconceptions about the legend, so that it clarifies it a bit more, so that the reports that we get aren't just these kind of vague abstractions that someone just happened to call a Wendigo, but they actually are a little bit more precise in what they're calling a Wendigo based on traditional lore.
For me, after nearly two decades of researching the Wendigo, I'm very humbled by it, by the fact that I still think I don't know much about it after doing the book and two decades of research, that I think there's so much more to learn. And this is like any other legend, that's what gave us so much apprehension going into it, is we thought it was too big. Mm. It was too puzzling, too complex to ever do a book about. And this is my 25th book, Paul, and I can tell you that I think it's the most important work that I've done. I don't want to speak for Kevin, and I think it's the one that will last the longest in terms of my research. If any of it does, I think it'll be this one. But it's one where I'm continually learning, that I have no doubt that 10 years from now, I'll know much more about the Wendigo than I do now, I hope. But I don't know if it's ever something where you can say that you know everything about it, or even close to everything about it. I think it's one of those folklore traditions that is going to be much bigger than any one person could wrap their heads around.
I think you're being very humble, both of you, because I think it is an incredible book. I think it's a fantastic work that you've brought together. I'm delighted. It's one of those books I'm delighted to have read it, because I've learnt a lot, and I think it's a very important piece of work because of the subject matter. And as you say, most of these tales were simply oral tradition. So I think it's always important to catalogue and capture such pieces of information, because it would be an absolute tragedy if these were lost from history. And as Kevin said, I really do hope it certainly doesn't take you 20 years, gentlemen, to do another volume, because I cannot wait to see what else you uncover and bring to us. So I would just say thank you very much, because I think it's a fabulous book and you should be both very, very proud of it.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you, and keep an eye out.
I certainly will. An eye out for the Wendigos more than anything now, gents.
you might want to get your hammock ready for this winter.
Oh, I'll leave that to you guys. So listen, where can everybody keep up to date with your work and get hold of a copy of this brilliant book?
Yeah, the easiest way is just backroadslore.com. More information on us than you'd ever want or need. Otherwise, wherever you buy books, you can find it as well.
Fantastic. Well, I'll put links in the show notes to your sites and obviously to the where people can get a copy. I highly recommend it for numerous reasons. If you're particularly bloodthirsty, or you love the supernatural, or you just need to get a handle on native folklore, I can't recommend it highly enough. So, like I say, thank you so much today, gentlemen, for your conversation. It's been brilliant, and I wish you the very best of luck with whatever you've got next.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.